I'm your host Musa Al-Bahrami, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss issues, questions, and other relevant circumstances or topics parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers are based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the household of the Prophet and, of course, of the Prophet himself. Peace be upon them all. Joining us in our studio is our guest speaker and dear friend, Sayyid Abdullah Musa, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Our topic today is about the different life phases of the child and how important it is to understand these phases. And to do that, we must understand how a child acts in these phases. The last phase we spoke about was the ages of 3 to 6 years old. We said that a child at this age is very curious. It's also fiercely defiant and rebellious, and also has a very, very sharp mind, which means that they remember many things at that young age. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه. So we were basically saying that as a parent, as an educator, you need to understand that throughout the life of a child, each year he would go through something, each year would change, and understanding the phase itself, it gives a bit of assurance to the parents to know that what's happening is actually normal and fine. So, for example, we say at the age of 4 and 4 plus, kids usually start asking questions about death, right?
Interesting.
So when kids start to ask about death and dying and where people go after they die, a lot of parents get scared and take that as a sign that their kids might be going through an emotional state,
right,
or something could be going wrong with them.
Just let me interrupt you for 1 second here, I'm sorry, but this sounds very philosophical. They're already talking about their own mortality.
well, that's how it works. So that's how life is. So at this age, if the child asks about death and dying and where people go, it is very natural in that age for them to be asking these questions, and all you have to do is just give them simple, basic answers that satisfies their understanding.
Right.
And sometimes, when especially when it comes to death, even grown-ups themselves, they don't have the proper answers to themselves, and because death is something that scares them,
right,
so they don't ask questions about it.
Or for Muslims, they do not have the correct theological beliefs or knowledge about it.
Yeah. Where, in fact, this is just a point that you just raised. When it comes to non-Muslims, I find them to be more active in this field than us. Sadly, I've seen many parents who are non-Muslims teaching their kids about the concept of death more smoothly, more flawlessly than us. They open this topic with their kids more than us. For example, in the West, well, because they have pets, they have dogs and cats, and sometimes these pets either die or they have to put them down. So they come and explain to their kids the concept of death.
Right. They say they must interrupt you because we will go on a quick break.
I am a Muslim, Islam my deen, Allah my Lord, His word Quran, Muhammad Prophet, peace be upon him. I am a Muslim for all of time. Someday, somehow, my journey here will end. I know not when Allah will call me home. This life I live, oh what a blessed thing. As death comes to me, these words I will sing.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRRV English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we're discussing about the different life phases of the child, and we just spoke about the life phase of the 4 years of age when children become curious about mortality and life after death. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
So we're saying that when a child asks these questions, it's very natural, very normal. It doesn't mean the child is suffering from any psychological problem
right,
or going through any mental breakdown or any emotional phase. That's just the age where kids start to wonder. So because we said at the age of 3, they ask a lot of questions, 10 to 15% of what they say is the questions. Now the questions are more in depth, they are more precise about events that they see, and they, you know, we can give them simple answers that satisfies their mind, and we shouldn't be afraid and back off from that. Then, right. For example, when we have kids at the age of 6, for example, girls at the age of 6, they are more messy. Obviously, we're not saying always, and all of them are like that. Some of them, this is the age, where they are a bit messy, they tend to forget a lot, they leave their stuff at school, their books or their bags or their belongings at their friends or school or places when they go out. So this is just natural. Most parents, they look at this kind of behavior as the child suffering something in his brain.
Or them being stupid.
Or being stupid. And sometimes parents end up shoving medicine in the kids' stomachs because they think they have a problem, being forgetful.
Right.
Or there's something wrong with them. So they start to worry. But the fact is, at this age, 6 and above, a child is more distracted. There's so many things happens around him that it's very natural for him to forget things. So it's not a matter of alert and to be, scared. It's just natural for a child to be at this age to forget things and to leave things behind. So when I forget things, I'm getting old. I'm forgetting because my brain literally dying out. But when a child who is just starting to grow and his mind is at his peak, it's just natural because they get distracted. So a mother, for example, should not mistake her girl for, being forgetful or there's something wrong with her brain or she's not being able to deal with things or she's even in terms of what we say, not being responsible.
Right.
Right. So parents always, they throw that card at their kids at this age. You're not responsible, you're not this, you're not that. No, just, understand that this is the phase, this is the time where kids go around this age.
Right.
And also the children, for example, at this age as well, or even less, more, they try to use crying, even at this age, 6 and above, they try to use crying as a way to seek attention. And to make people do the things that they want. So they use it as a weapon.
It became manipulative.
Yeah, so they use that as a crying. So, for example, you might talk to a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, 6-year-old, even 8-year-old, 9-year-old, and instantly they cry. And they use it because they know that through crying, they can get away with things.
Right.
They can get things, and they can get attention and seek attention.
Right.
So when you see a child crying, usually, automatically, you're going to feel bad towards them. So also they use that as a tool. Keep that in mind as well. That's just natural. Not that there's something wrong with them.
We will go on a quick break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Dear Sayyid, please pick up your list.
Okay, so there are a few more things I want to mention as well before we end this topic. Also, kids, for example, throughout their life, especially when they're young, they like to talk to themselves. They play with themselves. They talk to themselves. They talk to their imaginary friends. They talk to their toys and dolls. And that's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it is essential for them to build their personality through this way of talking to themselves and talking to things around them. That's how they grow. So they're not crazy. They don't have a talking problem.
Right.
They're not just imagining things that don't exist. And so some people say, well, there's something different wrong with my child. He imagined things. That's just very natural.
Might I ask, dear Sayyid, why does this help them develop their personality when they're speaking to themselves or to their thoughts?
Okay.
Kind of a strange concept, if I might add.
Okay, this is not a strange concept. It's a normal concept because, for example, when I talk with you, because for example, when I talk with you, I have the ability to communicate with you. And
right.
this ability didn't just came out just, you know, now.
Okay.
This developed from
right.
a young age.
It's
so
a process then.
It's a process. So at a young age, when I learned to talk, to make conversation with myself, that gives me the ability to have a conversation with someone else. So when I'm talking to my toy, what's happening in fact is my brain is kind of programming itself into being able to have a conversation with anyone else.
Interesting.
Yeah, so when I come
right.
to you and I talk to you and I talk to my parents and I talk to someone older, I know how to hold a conversation based on the fact that I had a prior training with my dolls.
Exactly, you have some experience. Yeah,
it
makes
some
sense.
Experience, right?
Makes sense now that you mention
it.
Where
kids who do not talk and they're not imaginative at a younger age,
right.
they find it very hard having and holding conversation as they
right.
grow old.
They become antisocial. Even.
Exactly, they're
right.
very antisocial because they
right.
never had that kind of imaginary playtime.
Right.
So we say now this is extremely natural, extremely necessary for the child to be at this age, talking to himself, putting words
right.
together, putting forming sentences, knowing how to even hear his own voice and speak out. So that's
right.
a very natural state for a child to be to go through. So that also needs to stay in the minds of parents.
Right.
And as a child gets into his teenage years and he becomes a teenager, obviously that's the time where the child wants to be completely independent, where the child
right.
is completely arrogant, and the child is completely,
right.
I don't know, he wants to be
everything
defiant.
Everything
they will in
your children, it's much
multiplies.
More. Right.
Now,
right.
everything multiplies, right? The voice change, the mood change, the body
right.
change, hormone change. The child goes through an absolute complete change. This
right.
is even Islamically, we call the age of bulugh, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, okay, now it's time for you to do the wajibat, to do the necessary things.
Right.
Also, this is a very sensitive time that parents need to read about and educate themselves about and how to deal with it, because it's a very sensitive, especially when it comes to matters of intimacy and sexuality with children. A lot of people,
right.
they kind of turn a blind eye.
It's a taboo for them and
yeah,
they never
so
discuss it.
Actually, it should be the opposite. It should be
right.
one of the topics that should be discussed first and foremost at this age. So this is an age, extremely sensitive age for a child, and parents need to be there, they need to be present at this time of a child's life, so at least he can do things smoothly and correctly. Yes,
right.
problems come up. Yes, the child will do, a teenager will do a lot of stupid things, haram things, but how we deal with them is what makes a difference. We can either turn a blind eye and let the child go his way, and God forbid, he'll go the wrong path, or we can work with him
themselves.
And save him and help him.
Right. Dear Sayyid, I thank you for your time, but we must end today's program. I also thank dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any questions, comments, or some feedback that they want to give us, they can find us at our website, parstoday.com, or they can write us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, they can also find us on our various social media accounts under the call sign of Call of Islam Radio. Dear listeners, thank you for tuning in yet again.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
In the limelight.
Anti-war activists have recently accused the Biden administration of throwing fuel on the flames of the Saudi-led war in Yemen after the U.S. State Department notified Congress it approved a new $650 million missile sale to the repressive West Asian monarchy. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Warnings of More Death and Suffering in Yemen as U.S. Moves to sell Saudi's missiles. Stay tuned for more. Anti-war activists have recently accused the Biden administration of throwing fuel on the flames of the Saudi-led war in Yemen after the U.S. State Department notified Congress it approved a new $650 million missile sale to the repressive West Asian monarchy. Defense News reports the Pentagon said the Saudi government requested to purchase 280 AIM-120C-7C8 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles and 596 LAU-128 missile rail launchers in a deal that would also include spare parts, support, and logistical services. The missiles would be fitted to Saudi warplanes, including Eurofighter Typhoons and McDonnell Douglas F-15s. Meanwhile, tweeted the women-led peace group Code Pink, one Yemeni child continues to die every 10 minutes as a result of the humanitarian crisis caused by the Saudi-led U.S.-backed war on Yemen. The missiles are made by Raytheon, whose board Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin joined upon retiring as head of the U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, in 2016. U.S. State Department spokesperson called the proposed sale fully consistent with the administration's pledge to lead with diplomacy to end the conflict in Yemen while also ensuring Saudi Arabia has the means to defend. Peace advocates scoffed at the claim that selling more weapons to the Saudis would help bring about peace. If approved by Congress, the sale would be the first to Saudi Arabia since President Joe Biden's February announcement that the U.S. was ending support for offensive operations, including weapons transfers, in the atrocity-laden Saudi-led war that has killed and wounded hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, while displacing hundreds of thousands more and exacerbating famine-like conditions through a crippling economic blockade. Prior to February's announcement, the Biden administration imposed a temporary freeze on all arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, pending a review of deals inked during the tenure of former President Donald Trump. Critics say the new sale is at least the third violation of Biden's offensive operations promise this fall. In May, Pentagon officials acknowledged the U.S. was still servicing Saudi warplanes via contractors, and in September, peace and human advocates denounced the State Department's approval of a $500 million contract to maintain the kingdom's military helicopters. In late September, the U.S. House passed an amendment by Representative Ro Khanna to the 2022 National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, that, if approved by the Senate and signed by Biden, would end U.S. logistical support and weapons transfer to Saudi Arabia. Eric Sperling, executive director of the D.C.-based advocacy group Just Foreign Policy, tweeted a thread of reports chronicling atrocities committed with helicopters during the Saudi-led U.S.-backed war. These include the killing of dozens of Yemeni fishers in a 2015 attack, an Apache helicopter strike on a boat full of Somali refugees that killed at least 40 people in 2017, and a double-tap airstrike that killed 30 civilians, including first responders, in 2015. Saudi Arabia Arabia's war crimes in Yemen, its monarchy's support for international terrorism, and its horrific human rights record have prompted calls from across the U.S. political spectrum for a re-evaluation of relations with the oil-rich and geostrategically important ally.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
This is for a better life. For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. In the previous episode, we talked about domestic violence, and we said that those who exercise domestic violence and those who use domestic violence in order to bully his family members, in order to force his family members into doing something, they take the holy verse of the Quran out of context. The Quran absolutely and clearly says that it's not permissible for a man to beat his wife, but if he beats it, he can beat her only if she is disobedient in matters related to matrimonial obligations, to conjugal rights. But beating doesn't mean that he can beat her to the extent that it leaves scars, bruises, a limb broken. Beating in the case of verse 34 of chapter 4 means that he can use a step-by-step procedure. The first step is not beating, and also beating means that he can use something to only threaten her. Like, for example, he can use a small stick, to just show his anger and resentment. Otherwise, beating is not allowed. If a person beats another person and his act of beating leaves the victim's body with bruises and with rashes and also with scars, then of course the person who was involved in the beating and the person who perpetrated the violence is liable for atonement. Now, dear brothers and sisters, the religion of Islam does not endorse such kind of violence. And of course, in order for us to live a better life, we need to forgive each other. We need to reconcile with each other. The husband and the wife, of course, they have to understand each other, because understanding, reconciliation, helps both the parties to the marriage to save their marriage, to ensure that their marriage is protected from falling apart. Now, the best thing, of course, sometimes quarrels take place. The husband and the wife, they have some kind of misunderstanding, and this misunderstanding sometimes does happen in every family, but it does not become a license for either side to attack the other side. It is always necessary for the husband and the wife to forgive each other, and that's how they can live a life of prosperity, a life of happiness, a life filled with hope, with compassion, with forgiveness, of course.
At this time, we have a short break, and then we'll listen to the continuation of the speech of Sheikh Javed Akbari.
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Islam is all about forgiveness. Now, I would like to talk about forgiveness in this episode. In Islam, of course, there are two kinds of forgiveness. Forgiveness from Allah to His servants who sin, who commit sins. So there's no doubt as to the fact that, of course, Allah is all forgiving. And then forgiveness among men who wrong and hurt each other. This is the second type of, or the second kind of forgiveness. And when it comes to forgiveness from Allah, of course, it is crystal clear. Allah is Ghafoor. Allah is all forgiving. It is one of Allah's name, which means He is the one who continuously and repetitively forgive the sinners perfectly and completely. There's no doubt about it. And there are verses in the Holy Quran which time and again repeat the fact that Allah forgives. Allah is the greatest forgiver. And of course, forgiveness is not only understood through the name Al-Ghafoor, or Ghafoor is one of the names of Allah, but of course God is Rahman, God is Rahim. Al-Rahman means that God is the most compassionate, He's the most merciful, and Rahim is also God is the beneficent, God is the compassionate. And these are the different names of Allah which suggest that God is forgiving and God does forgive. And the Holy Quran says in Surah Az-Zumar, verse 53, O my servants who have transgressed against themselves by sinning, do not despair of the mercy of Allah. Indeed, Allah forgives all sins. Indeed, it is He who is the forgiving and the merciful. This is one of those verses, and this is just an example of how much Allah is forgiving and how much merciful He is, how much forgiving Allah is. Forgiveness among men to each other is praised as a good virtue. Many verses of the Quran encourage people to forgive, even though they are wronged. For example, you know, you can see chapter Ali Imran, verse 134, where the Quran says, the believers are those who spend in charity during ease and hardship, and who restrain their anger and pardon the people, for Allah loves the doers of good. There's no doubt that Allah loves the doers of good. Not only He loves the doers of good, but He also rewards them. He gives them rewards. On the day of judgment, He will compensate. He will give them whatever they wish for. وَلَكُمْ فِيهَا مَا تَشْتَهِي أَنفُسُكُمْ وَلَكُمْ فِيهَا مَا تَدَّعُونَ. Of course, those who do good deed, they will go to paradise. And of course, the paradise is a place where everyone will have whatever they wish for. And that's the world where a person can wish for anything. And whatever he wishes for, Allah will give him. Forgiveness among men is another kind of forgiveness, you know. Forgiveness among men to each other is praised as a good virtue. Many verses of Quran encourage people to forgive, even though they are wronged. And the believers are those who spend in charity during ease and hardship, and who restrain their anger and pardon the people, for Allah loves the doer of the good. That is the verse which I recited. And of course, this is verse 134 of chapter Ali Imran.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
There are many ahadiths, there are many traditions, and one of those hadiths is Hadith Qudsi about forgiveness. In one occasion, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam sat together with his companions. He suddenly laughed. So one of his companions asked, what thing did make you laugh, Ya Rasulullah? The Prophet said, I laughed because of two men who shall kneel in the presence of the Lord of Power. One of them says, O my Lord, grant me retaliation for the wrong which my brother did to me. And God says to the wrongdoer, give your brother the rewards of your good deeds, that in which he was wronged. O Lord, he says, none of my righteous works remain. Then God the Exalted says to the man who made the demand, what shall you do with your brother, seeing that none of his righteous works remain? And he replies, O my Lord, let him bear some of my burdens, my sins, in my stead. And the Prophet wept as he said, truly, that shall be a fearsome day, a day when men have need of others to bear their burdens. Then he said, God shall say to one who made the request, lift up your head and look to the gardens. Gardens means paradise. Now, this he does, and he says, O my Lord, I see high cities of silver and golden palaces about with pearls. For which prophet shall they be, or which saint or martyr? And God said, they belong to whomsoever pays me their price. The hadith goes on, and it's all about forgiveness, about compassion, about mercy. Obviously, we need to understand that forgiveness is an important characteristic, and it is the quality of God's servants. It's also the quality, it's one of the attributes of Allah. Allah's name is Ghafoor, Allah's name is Rahim, Allah's name is Rahman, and of course, it's also one of the characteristics of man.
That was all for this program. Inshallah, we listen to other episode of this program, For a Better Life, same time, same channel. Fi amanillah.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. It's all I need. 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 Oh, 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 oh. Your love is all I need. All I need. And I know that you see how much you need. You need to.
love is all I need.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Taiwan is an island in East Asia which has been self-ruled since 1950. The People's Republic of China regards it as a breakaway region that must one day be reunited with the mainland. Beijing has never ruled out the use of force to bring the island under its control. The situation has become very tense since President Tsai Ing-wen came into office in 2016. She has said Taiwan is independent and not part of China. The United States and some of its European allies have been expanding their relations with Taiwan despite Chinese opposition. The Chinese government has been angered by the growing trade and military ties between the West and Taiwan. In response to the West's growing support for the island, China has been flexing its military muscles in the region. Tensions escalated this week between the U.S. and China over Taiwan after America's top general signaled that America stands ready to intervene if a conflict erupts in the region. U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Mark Milley said the U.S. military absolutely could defend Taiwan from a potential Chinese attack if asked to do so. How far is the United States really willing to go over Taiwan? Will it be ready to confront another nuclear-armed superpower, given all the risks and possible costs involved, where success is not guaranteed at all?
This sounds very much like typical political positioning before some sort of a negotiation. The United States certainly does not have any positive interest in making a war over Taiwan, except, of course, to sell weapons and to spend taxpayers' money.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said on Thursday that, quote, the negative and erroneous words and deeds of the U.S. related to the Taiwan question have encouraged the blatancy of the Taiwan secessionists. He also blamed Washington for the increasing tension across the Taiwan Strait. Beijing has reiterated that the issue of Taiwan is a red line that must not be crossed, but the West seems to be determined to challenge China. This week, the European Parliament's first official delegation to the island said Taiwan is not alone and called for measures to bolster EU-Taiwan ties. Beijing condemned the trip, urging the European side to correct its mistakes and not send any wrong signals to Taiwan, warning that it will harm China-EU relations. Where does Europe really stand on this issue?
The Europeans are typically following Germany and making supportive sounds in the support of U.S. foreign policy, but are not prepared to physically become engaged, especially after the debacle in Afghanistan. So I would suggest that we can call the European comments on this topic chatter on the line. In other words, a background noise that's not critical to the situation.
The EU seems to be following policies close to those of the U.S. The West knows all too well that China is highly unlikely to back down on the issue of Taiwan. Why is it then being so provocative? Is it trying to create a conflict in the region close to China's borders? The U.S. has been selling many billions of dollars worth of weapons to the self-ruled island. And U.S. President Joe Biden has made no secret of his priority to contain China's influence. This leaves little doubt that Taiwan will remain a very serious bone of contention between the two sides for years to come.
The naval forces of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, have managed to thwart an attempt by the United States to take over a giant oil tanker in the strategic sea of Oman. The U.S. military confiscated the Iranian tanker loaded with crude oil in the Sea of Oman, intended to unload the shipment to another tanker and then direct it to an unknown destination. But IRGC forces reacted promptly and carried out a heli-borne operation on the stolen ship's deck, gained control of the vessel, and directed it back toward Iran's territorial waters. U.S. forces then proceeded to chase the tanker using several helicopters and warships, but their attempt at taking over the vessel for a second time was thwarted again by Iranian naval forces. The tanker is currently in Iranian territorial waters and under the protection of IRGC's Navy.
The United States continues to use oil and weaponize oil against Iran because it has not been able to overthrow the Iranian Islamic Revolution in any other way.
Iran has repeatedly warned the U.S. about its military adventurism in the Persian Gulf. Tehran says it has increased its patrols to secure the passage of Iranian ships and to combat fuel smuggling in the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman.
The U.S. will try to provoke some sort of conflict in the Persian Gulf because of this, and we have to keep this in mind because the Persian Gulf belongs to Iran and the people of the Middle East, not the United States. The United States should not be there to begin with.
Iranian officials say U.S. military presence in the region is a source of instability and insecurity. Iran believes the countries of the region are fully capable of providing their own security. The latest confrontation between the U.S. and Iran comes amid rising bilateral and regional tensions.
The United States continues its presence in the Persian Gulf because it is a key geopolitical trade route. Most of the energy, commerce, petroleum, commodities that are exchanged on the global market are done so in the Persian Gulf, because if we look geographically at a map, the Persian Gulf connects trade in Europe across Egypt through the Suez Canal and leads into the Indian Ocean.
Washington has tried to disrupt the legitimate oil trade of Iran with other countries. The U.S. has threatened Iran over its fuel deliveries to Lebanon and Venezuela. It believes that the sanctions it has imposed on Iran should be adhered by Iran under its so-called maximum pressure campaign. But this is a campaign that has failed, even admitted by some U.S. officials. Tensions have risen between Iran and the U.S. after the U.S. pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal. The U.S. left the deal as part of a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The campaign included tough economic sanctions combined with credible military threat. Washington's European allies failed to live up to their commitments.
For many years, since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the United States, Washington, London, the Western imperialist powers have done everything they can to try to overthrow the popular revolution, the government.
The administration of U.S. President Biden says it wants to rejoin the deal, but at the same time, it is pressing ahead with failed maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has also said in a tweet that the talks to remove sanctions on Iran would fail unless U.S. President Joe Biden could guarantee that Washington would not renege on the nuclear agreements in the future.
And the U.S. maintains its presence in the Persian Gulf because it sees that Iran has been able to withstand so many imperialist attacks, and also that Iran has many friends around the world. Let's recall just a few weeks ago in the lead up to this piracy by the U.S. that Iran was able to successfully bring petroleum refineries to the nation of Venezuela.
Now talks have been set to resume on November 29th, but the talks are aimed at removing illegal U.S. sanctions imposed on Iran. That is Iran's approach towards the talks. Only time will tell whether the U.S. will remove the sanctions or that the talks will fail.
November 2nd marks the anniversary of a declaration that proved disastrous to the Palestinian people. The Balfour Declaration is named after Lord Arthur Balfour, the then British Foreign Secretary who penned the document. The Balfour Declaration was a public statement issued by the UK government during World War I, announcing support for the creation of Israel. Palestinians view the declaration as a prelude to the Israeli occupation of their homeland in 1948, saying the UK government should apologize for issuing the document. The war leading to Israel's creation caused some 750,000 Palestinians either to flee or being expelled from their homes in what they called the Nakba or catastrophe. The British allowed the Jews to establish self-governing institutions, such as the Jewish Agency, while the Palestinians were forbidden from doing so, paving the way for the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine.
It's absolutely the source of the conflict. People who pretend that the deterioration began in 1967 with Israel's conquest of the West Bank and Gaza are deluding themselves. Zionism was a colonizing project which set out to establish a Jewish majority to remove as many Palestinians as they possibly could.
Emboldened by the Balfour Declaration and the ensuing Western support, Israel captured huge swathes of Arab land in a war in 1948 and then proclaimed its existence. In 1967, it proceeded to capture more Palestinian territory in another war. It then started propping up scores of settlements across that occupied territory in a move to gradually annex it. Tel Aviv has defied all international condemnations of its settlement activities, including outright denunciation by the United Nations.
And because Zionism is a system of Jewish supremacy over Palestinians across the whole of Palestine. The Zionists came to Palestine not to live alongside the Palestinians, not to be immigrants like in a normal country, but to displace the Palestinians. So yes, the problem is Zionism, and until the Zionist program of colonization and dispossession is ended, there's no possibility of a resolution to the crisis.
There are a set of reasons over which there is a general consensus about why Britain issued the Balfour Declaration. Control over Palestine was a strategic imperial interest to keep Egypt and the Suez Canal within Britain's sphere of influence. Britain sided with the Zionists to rally support among Jews in the United States and Russia, hoping they could encourage their governments to stay in the war until victory. There was also intense Zionist lobbying and strong connections between the Zionist community in Britain and the British government. Some of the officials in the government were Zionists themselves. While Britain is generally held responsible for the Balfour Declaration, it is important to note that the statement would not have been made without prior approval from the other Allied powers during World War I.
Colonialism was substantially rolled back and defeated in the 50s and 60s and 70s with independence for countries in Africa and Asia. So the Israeli project is an anachronism. It's out of time. It flies in the face of the laws that were passed in Nuremberg after the Second World War against the conquest of territory by force and the dispossession of the natives. But the Palestinians don't seem to be protected by that law.
In 1917, British ministers decided that the views of U.S. President Wilson should be obtained before any declaration was made. According to documents, the ministers recalled Arthur Balfour, confirming that Wilson was extremely favorable to the movement. France was also involved and announced its support prior to the issuing of the Balfour Declaration. A May 1917 letter from Jules Cambon, a French diplomat, to Nahum Sokolow, a Polish Zionist, expressed the sympathetic views of the French government towards, quote, Jewish colonization in Palestine.
Kingdom and France have gotten into a bitter diplomatic row. The two countries have been at odds over post-Brexit fishing rights in the British territorial waters. The UK gives out licenses to foreign vessels wishing to fish in its waters, but Paris says some fishing boats have been denied permission to enter areas they have fished in for years. London says the licenses have been distributed according to the post-Brexit deal it reached with the European Union last December. The dispute escalated to the point where a British trawler was seized by French officials, prompting the UK to summon Paris's ambassador in London, a move that's usually made against enemies and not allies. Paris threatened London with sanctions if the issue isn't resolved by the 2nd of November. The UK Foreign Secretary launched a counterattack against France, vowing legal action if Paris doesn't back down.
It's unclear. It's always unclear as to who is correct or incorrect, but usually they are resolved in a peaceful, diplomatic manner. But we live in an age of a growing nationalism in which international institutions are breaking down. And so as a result, a minor spat over fishing rights is turning into a major international crisis.
Threats have raised concerns about a larger trade dispute between two of Europe's largest economies. The fishing issue was one of the key points dragging the Brexit talks. Although fishing constitutes a small portion of France and Britain's economies, it holds substantial political significance as it's the main lifeline for the coastal communities. Apart from the fishing disputes, the two countries have recently clashed over the AUKUS agreement, under which Australia ditched a multi-billion-dollar submarine deal with France for a similar one with the US and UK.
So it's the French were appalled, extremely angry by America's peremptory behavior, and they are looking for a way of striking back. And Boris Johnson didn't make things any better by taunting the French when the AUKUS alliance became news, by taunting them in the crudest schoolboy manner.
Britain's departure from the EU has also negatively affected its economy. Official data forecast a 4% economic slowdown for the country in the long run in the aftermath of its exit from the bloc, while the COVID-19 impact is estimated to cut Britain's gross domestic product by 2%. Brexit also cast doubts on the future of the 1998 Irish peace deal, as it would mean a hard border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is part of the EU. Although the two sides settled the issue, the agreement that has been implemented since January this year has led to the disruption of trade between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, causing disagreements between London and Brussels. The UK government now wants the deal rewritten. Experts believe the long lines and brawls at the fuel stations across Britain are going to be the new normal for life in the post-Brexit UK.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allah.
Imam Khomeini recommended believers and faithful people to correct and amend their ways in accordance with the teachings of the Holy Scripture of the Holy Quran by acting upon divine commands. Imam Khomeini says, "Actually, man would not recklessly run wild if he considered it all likely. He needed not have certainty that which is reported in the Noble Quran is right, the promises and the threats, and that he should amend his ways and deeds." Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. He has PhD on Islamic science.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We are with another golden saying of Imam Khomeini. Today, we will talk about his viewpoints in regards to the propagation of Islam. Imam Khomeini has said that enhance the teachings of Islam among the people, for at the top of affairs are these teachings of Islam, and if they are set right, all other matters shall follow suit. We are talking about the propagation of Islam and the teachings of Islam and spreading the words of Islam. Within the Islamic teachings, we know that it is known as Amar bil Ma'ruf wa Nahi anil Munkar, means order for the good and forbid from the forbidden things. So stop from the forbidden, order to the good and stop from the forbidden. We know that in Islam, the teachings are very important, and the civilizations, the cultures, the people who advance, it's based on the teachings. And since Islam is a complete religion about whom Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said that al-yawm akmaltu lakum dinakum wa atmamtu alaykum ni'mati, today we have completed your religion and the blessings, wa raditu lakum al-islam dina, and Allah said that he is happy for Islam, he wants Islam to be the final religion. So this is the wordings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the almighty Allah. Then obviously we should spread the words of Islam. Islam that will take us to the peak, that will take us to the advanced levels, inshallah. So we need to propagate Islam, as Imam Khomeini also has emphasized on it. And we know that the revolution that happened, or that was brought by Imam Khomeini, was an Islamic revolution. And this revolution happened because he propagated Islam in his people in its true way. Therefore, he was a true leader and he has propagated the Islam. Inshallah, may Allah give us tawfiq to work for Islam. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.